Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa, bringing you the News Gazette on this June 4th, Wednesday, 2025. Today on the front page is a picture, a large picture, and very colorful, with the heading, Court is in Session. And it's a picture of a young boy and some children crossing a very colorful court with the heading, Open in Time for a Busy June, the freshly painted basketball courts at Douglas Park in Champaign. Visiting artist Ryan Adams and his crew of five spent a week bringing the mural, Unite, Do Right, to life at the courts. The dedication ceremony for the latest mural to be added to the Champaign County African American Heritage Trail will be held at Douglas Park on June 14th as part of a Juneteenth celebration. And it is colorful indeed, with yellows, greens, orange, red geometrical shapes all painted on the court. At the top of the front page is an article about Homeland Security Department. It's from St. Joe, by Luke Taylor. St. Joe aghast over sanctuary designation. Village leaders say they've tried to stay out of that particular debate. A list of sanctuary jurisdictions published by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security last week included most Illinois counties, alongside just seven specific cities and villages: Chicago, Berwyn, Evanston, Oak Park, Skokie, Urbana, and St. Joseph. Some on the list have come as little surprise, but St. Joseph officials say they weren't expecting inclusion. You weren't as surprised as we were, newly elected Mayor Jim Page told the News Gazette on Tuesday. We were aghast. We know that being listed as such might affect us getting grants. Page and the village administrator Joseph Hackney both say that the village's resistance to being listed as a sanctuary jurisdiction comes not from a political perspective, but from a desire to be left out of the federal immigration debate. We feel as though this is a data scraping error, or something to that effect, and are optimistic that they will be removed from the list, Hackney said. Homeland Security took down the entire list just days after publishing it, though DHS officials say it will be updated regularly. Sanctuary jurisdiction is not a defined legal term, but the DHS said the list was of municipalities, counties, and states that are deliberately obstructing the enforcement of federal immigration laws and endangering American citizens. Page and Hackney heard Friday that St. Joe, population 3,772, was included and quickly reached out to the Office of U.S. Republican Mary Miller from Oakland, a representative from Oakland, for support in getting removed from the list. Hackney said her office has been very helpful, though Page said Village is yet to hear back from the Homeland Security itself. St. Joseph isn't the only town to say it was included mistakenly. Being designated a sanctuary city is a bad thing in that it's inaccurate, Page said. We have not weighed in one way or the other. Weighed in on immigration. Anybody that knows anything about St. Joe knows that we're not getting involved. Page said he'd be concerned if the list was still up online because anybody researching the town who was considering moving or opening a business there could find it and be swayed by inaccurate information. It's a three-day problem that came and went, he said. We're not worried about it. Village trustee Art Rapp only heard about the whole thing after the list was taken down and at first glance assumed it was a joke. The people of St. Joseph, at least the vast majority, would not gravitate toward being a sanctuary city. I think they'd be pretty offended, Rapp said. He was glad the mayor and village administrator were working with Miller and added that it might be worthwhile to contact some Democrat leaders as well, since this is just about correcting an error. After all, Rapp said, it isn't bad to be open-minded about potential policies. It's not true, but it might be beneficial to start a conversation, he said. That's also how at least one St. Joseph resident sees it, Even if the label was unintentional, Lucas Charters said it could lead to helpful conversations. This could be a chance to talk more about what it means to support everyone in the community, including immigrants. He said things like safety, fairness, and making sure people feel welcome and protected are values most people can support no matter what the label is. Charters said he knows this town. His town hasn't taken a strong position on immigration, so he was surprised by the designation, but is in favor of a lot of the ideas behind sanctuary policies, including those that cover the entire state through the Trust Act. When people trust the police and aren't afraid of being turned over to immigration officers, they're more likely to report crimes, go to the doctor, or send their kids to school, Charters said. That kind of trust makes everyone safer. Another St. Joseph resident, Sean Skinner, didn't find it at all surprising to see the town on the list. He's a football coach and business teacher at St. Joseph Ogden High School, where he says he's talked about things like the definition of sanctuary city. As Skinner sees it, a large part of that designation has to do with prioritizing local public safety and community trust over federal enforcement, which is a value he recognizes as important to St. Joseph. We have a really strong presence of local law enforcement agents who reside here, and they're wonderful people, and they contribute to our community, he said. I think this might speak to the fact that we believe in them to understand what our community values and the people who make up our community. On the other hand, he recognizes that very focus on local issues means the village would lean toward removing itself from a conversation on federal legislation. What I know to be true of our community is that we have a history of when other people are suffering or when other people are in need, we come to their aid, Skinner said. I'd like to believe we could do that for anybody and that we would do that for anybody. Continuing on the front page, an article from the Urbana City Council by Jana Wiersema with the title, Mayor, City Will Not Be Bullied. Budget proposal set aside several million in case of federal cuts. As budget discussions ramp up, the city officials say Urbana needs to prepare for the possibility of losing federal funds due to its sanctuary city status. Urbana will not be bullied, Mayor Deshaun Williams told the city council Monday night. Our sanctuary city status reflects our values and dignity, safety, and community for all. So if the federal government wants to fight over human rights, they'll find Urbana standing strong and unshaken in that regard. However, he also said that standing firm may come at a cost. We're on the list, said Elizabeth Hannon, Director of Finance and Interim City Administrator. We're on the Department of Homeland Security list. We all know that. There's considerable uncertainty about exactly what that means and how much damage is going to be done by the current federal administration. In light of this uncertainty, the city's proposed budget for fiscal year 2026 includes a $3.1 million allocation from the general fund in case of cuts to community development block grant and home funding. The dollars would be used to maintain existing programs and staffing over the next 4 years in the event that funds are reduced or eliminated, Williams wrote in an introduction to the proposed budget. The Trump administration has called for the elimination of CDBG and HOME. Programs arguing that both federal initiatives would be better managed at the state and local levels. Even though that money has not disappeared yet, we fully expect that it will, Hannon said, and even if the next federal administration wants to bring it back, they can't spin up a whole agency overnight. The proposed budget would also set aside $1.5 million from the general fund to support community programs not administered by the city. The sum includes a $500,000 transfer from the general reserve fund. Williams explained that federal fund programs such as the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, administered by the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, and housing vouchers through the Champaign County Housing Authority are also in danger of losing funds. While the city cannot fully offset all potential federal funding losses, we must be prepared to step up where we can, prioritizing housing stability and homelessness prevention, he said. He added that both the $3.1 million and the $1.5 million would remain in reserve and could not be spent without City Council approving a budget amendment. The city is also hoping to maintain some financial flexibility by implementing a 1% grocery tax to replace the state-administered tax that will be eliminated on January 1, 2026, Hannon said. According to Williams, losing the tax would cost the city about $1 million in annual revenue that the city relies on to provide essential services. He also noted that many other cities across the state have chosen to maintain the tax. Another notable piece of draft budget is a proposal to increase police staffing to support Chief Larry D. Boone's plan for a community engagement team pilot. Williams wrote that persistent staffing shortages in patrol have made it hard to move officers into non-enforcement, community-focused roles. His proposed budget includes adding 3 patrol officers to help stabilize basic staffing levels and free up capacity to launch more community-centered efforts. This would result in $367,000 in annual costs and one-time costs of $207,000 in fiscal year 2026. Also proposed, a sergeant to oversee the community engagement team with an annual cost of approximately $150,000 during the 3-year pilot and $873,000 tentatively reserved from the general fund for the second and third years of the program. Fiscal year 2026 will be the first year of the pilot, Hannon said. When asked by Alderman James Quisenberry if the proposed budget includes funding for space and furniture to support the program, Hannon replied, "Yes, it is. It's all rolled over into the next year, everything that they need to implement the program." The proposed budget also includes $112,500 to continue hiring incentives for the police department. "We feel like that's necessary because every other agency that's competing with us for police officers is continuing their hiring incentives," Hannon said. Williams also wrote that the Alternative Response Task Force is continuing its work, and building a safer community requires a both-and approach, not either-or. For FY 2025 fiscal year, $150,000 was budgeted for initial costs related to an alternative response model and $300,000 budgeted on a recurring basis for potential program costs based on the Alternative Response Task Force recommendations, he said. The $150,000 in one-time costs has been carried over to fiscal year 2026, along with remaining $55,000 allocated for the public safety study, which will be used for the consultant who will work with the task force. The proposed budget also includes a one-time cost of $25,000 to support families who are eligible for reparations as determined by the Champaign-Urbana Reparations Coalition. Williams wrote that this is part of the city's initial investment in reparations for Black residents of Urbana. Funding is allocated for a reparations study in collaboration with the Champaign-Urbana Reparations Coalition, advancing efforts to address historical inequities in our community, he told the council. The full budget proposal can be viewed on the city's website. It includes a total of $93.4 million in expenses and $78.4 million in revenues across all city funds. Williams said the difference is mainly due to spending in capital improvement funds being higher than revenues. According to Hannon, the City Council will hold a public hearing on the proposed budget in its June 16th committee meeting and vote on its adoption on June 23rd. At the bottom of the front page, an article from the Make-A-Wish Illinois Foundation with the title, "Hawaii-Bound Families Wish to Thank the Community," by Jennifer Bailey from Potomac. 16-year-old Alea Carley, who was diagnosed with leukemia 2 years ago, is not one to be the center of attention. But today is different, as she prepares for her 4 p.m. Make-A-Wish send-off celebration before heading to Hawaii. Alea and her family want to make time to thank the community for all its support and generosity. They'll get their chance at today's 4 p.m. Luau-themed party at Potomac Grade School before taking off for Oahu. It will be a nice getaway, said Mom Teresa, who will join husband Jim, Aaliyah, and Aaliyah's siblings, Rylan, Baylor, on the trip, made possible by wish granters like Corey Sheeler of Normal and Heather McCarty of Oakwood, according to Make-A-Wish Illinois. Aaliyah, who will be a junior this fall at Armstrong Township High School, was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia, a blood cancer, in December of 2022, and had a bone marrow transplant in May of 2023. Today, everything looks very promising, Teresa said on the way back from Aaliyah's two-year post-transplant appointment at Memphis's St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, where a social worker hatched the Make-A-Wish idea. Aaliyah said she's most looking forward to the warm weather. Hawaii won out over a Christmastime visit to New York City, which she figured she could do on her own another time. Also in her long-range plans, becoming a nurse, like the ones who've been by her side on every step of her healthcare journey. I just want to be a person that they were for me, she said, with a picture of the Carley family provided at the bottom. Let's take a break and head over to J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History with an article about Titanic's ill-fated sister. And there is a picture of an old-looking ship entitled the Britannic. It's seen circa 1915 during World War I when she was pressed into service by the British Admiralty as a hospital ship. As the 20th century dawned, the owners of Britain's White Star Line were thinking big, really big. They envisioned three huge ocean liners that would be larger and far more luxurious than anything the world had ever seen. The trio would make crossing the Atlantic an opulent pleasure for the era's super rich, and that would give the White Star an advantage that its business rivals, such as Cunard Line, could never hope to match. The first of the three, RMS Olympic, was launched with much fanfare in 1911. Her $7.2 million price tag alone, nearly one-third of a billion in today's dollars, was staggering. She quickly set the bar for the sumptuousness at sea that stood until RMS Titanic was christened the following year. For 6 days in April 1912, the Titanic cruised on her maiden voyage, sailing straight into disaster and legend. Nearly 115 years later, fascination with her short, sad life shows no signs of abating. Which brings us to her kid sister, RMS Britannic, was supposed to be the grand finale, the best of the bunch, the ship that would add an exclamation point to the White Star's dominance of the waves. It didn't turn out that way. For starters, some believe the ship was initially supposed to have been named Gigantic, which makes sense since Olympic, Titanic, and Gigantic all evoke visions of gargantuan scale. However, Titanic's untimely demise is thought to have led the builders to switch to a more patriotic sounding, at least to the English travelers, name of Britannic. Her completion was delayed by several modifications made after the Titanic tragedy. Britannic was finally launched in February 1914 and was still being fitted out in August when World War I started. Britain's Admiralty quickly pressed private ships into government service. Although owners were paid handsomely for the wartime loan of the vessels, the risk of losing them was high. But what choice did they have? Before Britannic ever got a chance to make the transatlantic journey she was designed for, she initially considered as a troop transport. However, she was soon needed for more urgent service. In 1915, Britain launched the disastrous Gallipoli campaign, largely the brainchild of Winston Churchill. It was intended to seize the European part of Germany's partner, the Ottoman Empire, which is now Turkey. Instead, it was a bloody failure that left nearly 31,000 British soldiers dead and another 80,000 injured and sick. So, Britannic was turned into a humongous hospital ship. Her immense size made her ideal for the unhappy task of caring for thousands of injured and ailing soldiers. Her owners were given 4 weeks to overhaul her to specifications for her new duties and repaint her with large red crosses to indicate her humanitarian mission. inside 3,309 beds, plus several operating rooms, were installed. Her first voyage in her new role in late December of 1915 went well. Two more followed when the Admiralty called her up again in August of 1916. It was all downhill from there. Her fourth voyage involved battling an especially vicious storm. Her fifth voyage had the entire crew quartered, battling a nasty foodborne illness. Her sixth voyage to the Mediterranean began on November 12th. She was sidelined at Naples by bad weather. When the clouds broke, her captain decided to make a run for it. By the morning of November 21st, she was sailing at full speed with 1,066 people on board near the Greek island of Chia, about 60 miles from Athens. And then it happened. At 8:12 a.m., she was rocked by a terrific explosion. Britannic had hit a powerful mine. The blast on the starboard side severely damaged a watertight compartment. Four watertight bulkheads were soon rapidly filling up. Britannic, like her older sister, was doomed. This time, the majority of passengers and crew were safely evacuated in 35 lifeboats. 30 lives were lost, a far cry from the 1,517 who perished on the Titanic 4 years earlier. However, Britannic went to the bottom much faster, sinking in only 55 minutes, compared to the 2 hours and 40 minutes it took the Titanic to go under. Britannic was the largest ship sunk during World War I. Famed oceanographer Jacques Cousteau discovered the wreck in 1975. She rests on the floor of the Aegean Sea today, on her side, largely forgotten in a world still obsessed by the legacy of her more famous, but no less ill-fated, big sister. Together, they are twin reminders of the adage that bigger doesn't always mean better. Moving on to section A8, with the heading of State from Capital News, Illinois, an article about Shield Law, University Admissions Foster Placement Bills Clear the General Assembly, from Springfield. More than 150 bills moved through the General Assembly in the final week of the legislative session that will make their way to the governor, including measures touching on drug approval, college admissions, and foster placement. House Bill 3637 aims to protect medical providers who prescribe drugs that were previously approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, but had the approval revoked, provided the drug is still recommended by the World Health Organization. The bill is part of a larger trend of blue states adopting SHIELD laws, legislation guaranteeing the legal backing of medical providers from federal and interstate litigation, typically over abortion medications or vaccinations. HB 3637 is sponsored by Representative Dagmara Avalar, a Democrat from Romeoville, and has more than two dozen co-sponsors. Under the bill, if the FDA pulled its approval of a drug any time after January 1st of 2025, it can't be considered adulterated, as long as it's still recommended by the WHO. This current administration has made it very clear that there are certain drugs that they would like to pull approval from, Avalar said. When a drug is considered adulterated, that means it's generally not normal or made to conform with good manufacturing practice, like an FDA-approved drug. Doctors, nurses, and other medical providers can lose their licenses for providing adulterated drugs. But the bill would make it so that providers would not be subject to the penalties provided in law for prescribing such drugs. The law also includes provisions that the Department of Financial and Professional Regulation can't revoke or suspend the ability to practice medicine from a slew of medical professions based solely on the person's license, registration, or permit status. Speaking in opposition, Representative Bill Howder, a Republican from Morton, a practicing physician, said it was dangerous to base a drug's safety on a WHO recommendation. It's not just for a small amount of drugs here, it's for all the drugs, Howder said. The bill language does not touch on the formula for Medicaid or any requirements about what insurance companies must cover. However, Medicaid is required to cover the cost of any FDA-approved drug. The bill passed the House 76-39 and cleared the Senate 38-19. University enrollment. If signed by the governor, a bill would mandate high school seniors and community college students automatically be offered enrollment to all state schools for which their GPA qualifies them. The bill does not change universities and colleges' GPA standards or admission requirements. Schools can revoke a student's automatic admission if, after reaching out to the student, they discover that they don't meet other eligibility requirements. The main sponsor of HB 3522, Katie Stewart, a Democrat from Edwardsville, said the state wants to encourage students not to leave Illinois for other institutions. If it becomes law, the Illinois Board of Higher Education and the Illinois Community College Board would start the program in 27-28. It passed the House by a vote of 103-10. Next, foster placement. A bill clarifying that the Department of Children and Family Services can't place children in a household with anyone who has a history of human trafficking or sex trafficking is one step away from becoming law as well. HB 871 cleared both chambers without opposition. Its chief sponsor, Amy Briel, a Democrat from Ottawa, said it was brought forward because of an incident in her district. However, House Republicans pointed out that a bill with the same intention, House Bill 4095, was introduced in a previous General Assembly by Republicans. Their draft came after a report was published by CBS News Chicago about DCFS placing a 16-year-old sex trafficking victim with a 24-year-old man with sex trafficking charges. Another, hair braiding. A bill that would have repealed licensing requirements for hair braiders in Illinois died in the final stretch of the session after opponents voiced concerns about how deregulation could impact health, safety, and equity for the profession. The Hair Braiding Opportunity Act, HB 3356, would have amended the Barber Cosmetology Aesthetics, Hair Braiding, and Nail Technology Act of 1985 to strike a 300-hour training requirement, $30 initial licensing fee, and $5,000 penalty for practicing without a license for hair braiders. Members of the Illinois Association of Hair Braiders said a repeal would have reversed hard-won strides for the profession. When you X this license out, you undo the work that black women have been doing to be recognized in the beauty industry, said Tamikia Swint, a licensed hair braiding instructor and owner of an Oak Park salon. Continuing on in this state section, a piece from Springfield by Bridget Fox with the title Native American Imagery, Mascot Banned Stalls as Land Conservation Bill Advances. Illinois legislative session concluded without passage of a Native American K-12 school mascot ban. Despite desire from Native Americans in Illinois, the ban on the Native imagery for mascots in K-12 schools stalled in the Senate after it made its way out of the House. House Bill 1237, Senate sponsor Senator Susie Glowiak-Hilton, a Democrat from Western Springs, said after the bill missed a deadline earlier this session, she was still gathering a consensus from other legislators. But, she said, many of the concerns she heard about the measure stemmed from the cost associated with schools changing mascots. We will continue conversations about it and see what we can do with helping them pass it, Glowiak-Hilton said when the bill missed its mid-May deadline. Native American advocates told Capital News Illinois earlier this year about the importance of improving Native imagery. Our identity has been frozen in time, and it's going to stay frozen in time as long as we're portrayed as mascots and things of the past, said Matt Baudet, a citizen of the Montauk tribe of Indians who was in Springfield to advocate for the bill's passage. Andrew Johnson, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and executive director of the Native American Chamber of Commerce of Illinois, said how Natives are often portrayed as mascots in school logos has a detrimental effect of costuming. It is really not a sense of honor there, he said. It is not a sense of history. In fact, it's a perversion of history to think that these mascots are maintaining any kind of that memory of Native people. And we're going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette. Please stay tuned. I'll be right back.